Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 348, titled Machiavelli 101. This is being recorded on February 17th of 2002, and it is yet another broadcast dealing with the events in and around and following, and in some cases preceding, the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. We're going to be looking in this broadcast at a convergence between sort of cynical, opportunistic, no-brainer approaches to policy, or at least what are hypothesized as that, and also deep Machiavellian cynical power ploys in realpolitik. What I'm going to suggest, and this will appear remarkable to some listeners, is that this will that I suspect that certain elements are operating opportunistically, and that within that context, certain other elements, particularly elements that I have termed the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like style underground from the end of World War II, I will suggest that whereas some elements have been operating opportunistically and with a very short-sighted perspective, others have been operating within that context in a very cynical and deliberate and far-sighted perspective. Long-range perspective would be a better word. One could perhaps compare this convergence with the way a mosquito transmits malaria. It's not out to transmit malaria. It's out to suck blood. But when it bites more than one victim, it winds up transmitting the organism and spreading the disease. And I think that's a good metaphor. We're going to begin by looking at an excerpt from a book we've used many times in the recent past. It's called Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. It's authored by Richard LaBeviere, translated by Martin Demer. The book was published in softcover by Algora Publishers. You can visit their website at www.algora.com. The ISBN number is 1-892941-06-6. The book was originally published in French in 1999 and published by Algora in English in 2000. In a chapter ironically called Is There a Pilot on Board the U.S. Aircraft?, referring to questions concerning the direction and stability of U.S. policy, the author describes in an excerpt that we've used previously the Baklavization of American foreign policy, where there are various competing elements at different levels, which produces something analogous to a baklava pastry. We're going to also take a look here at the discussion by the author of the conflict or the convergence between short-sighted and very unwise policy and a carefully constructed Machiavellism, as he calls it. Big brother or a ship without a rudder? It's hard to tell, especially when one is analyzing Islamism as seen from Washington. Illustrating the pragmatism inspired by Anglo-Saxon virtues in the field of international relations, an eminent advisor to the State Department today asserts, quote, the need for an incoherent foreign policy, unquote. The same man recognizes off-camera that in these matters the Secret Service, translation the intelligence services, has more power than the State Department. If you want to understand that, he says, just look at Irangate, a typical scandal. We'll come back to the Iran-Contra scandal later on in the program. Continuing, although a major shakeup ensued within the U.S. intelligence services, that did not change a thing in terms of the international tribulations of the world's primary power, which continuously oscillates between improvisation with no thought for tomorrow and a carefully constructed Machiavellism. Now, in previous discussion of Richard LaBeviere's book, we've taken a look at the information he has presented, which alleges profound support for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, not only from Saudi Arabia, but also by a faction of U.S. intelligence associated with the petroleum industry. And what we're going to be looking at some of the first part of this broadcast is the apparent use, hypothesized to a certain extent by Richard LaBeviere, of al-Qaeda as basically a geopolitical lever for corporate interests, which are interested in extracting wealth and consequently utilizing Al-Qaeda in a cynical geopolitical fashion, which is at the same time relatively short-sighted and also in some ways Machiavellian. I would suggest that within that context, there is another element at work, namely the Underground Reich, which is not only looking to develop resources, but which is looking to turn world opinion against the United States and ultimately to destroy or isolate and neutralize American power, and also to annihilate Israel and wipe out world Jewry. Again, the Underground Reich. Taking a look now at one of the Machiavellian applications of Al-Qaeda, in the past we've taken a look at the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Saudi intelligence, and in turn and by extension elements of U.S. intelligence associated with the petroleum industry. The New York Times of Friday, January 18th of 2002, had an op-ed column by Richard Butler, who is a scholar in residence at the Council on Foreign Relations and has recently published a paper called Fatal Choice, Nuclear Weapons and the Illusion of Missile Defense. The CFR, of course, a major geopolitical think tank with close connections to the Rockefeller interests. This op-ed column is called A New Oil Game with New Winners, and it refers to the traditional great game, a policy of geopolitics played in the 19th century between the British and Russian empires, and talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and something that we've looked at in For the Record programs 328 and 334, namely the fact that UNICAL and British Petroleum and the Saudis are planning on putting a pipeline through Afghanistan in order to, and Pakistan also, by the way, in order to basically take oil from the Caspian Sea and market it. Bear in mind that the elder George Bush has a very heavy investment in UNICAL. Richard Butler writes, "The war in Afghanistan is most relevant in two respects. First, it has made the construction of a pipeline across Afghanistan and Pakistan politically possible for the first time since UNICAL and the Argentinian company Bridas competed for the Afghan rights in the mid-1990s. And I would suggest that there are elements, and in a future broadcast called Timeline, I'm going to review some of the very disturbing indications that some elements of our national security establishment had a forewarning of September 11th. We're going to be taking a look at some of the, we're going to be reviewing some of those indications in a future broadcast. Now, thinking in terms of relatively cynical and short-sighted geopolitics, and specifically utilizing Al-Qaeda and Islamism or Islamic fundamentalism as a lever through which either areas could be split off so that their natural resources could be utilized, or which could be used to coerce certain areas into allowing the development of natural resources by in multinational corporate interests. One of the areas where Islamic fundamentalism and also elements of Al-Qaeda have been very active has been in China, specifically in Xinjiang province, and I may be mispronouncing that, Xinjiang. That is a resource-rich province, and it also has a very large Muslim population called the Uyghurs, U-I-G-H-U-R. Turning again to Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, China has not been spared. Xinjiang, southern China, has a population that is 55% Uyghur, a Turkophone Sunni ethnic group. It has been confronted with Islamist violence since the beginning of the 1990s. Created in 1955, Xinjiang, which means new territory, is one of the five autonomous areas of China and is the largest administrative unit of that country. The area is highly strategic at the geopolitical level. Chinese nuclear tests and rocket launches take place at the Lop Nor test grounds, as well as from an economic standpoint, since it abounds in natural wealth, oil, gas, uranium, gold, etc. Against this backdrop, attacks have proliferated by independence-seeking cliques, all preaching holy war. Some are acting in the name of Turkish identity, while others are fighting in the name of Allah, especially in the southern part of the region. As in the rest of Central Asia, in Xinjiang we are witnessing the rising influence of Wahhabi groups and the increasing proselytism of preachers from Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Traditionally allied with popular China, Pakistan is nevertheless trying to extend its influence to this part of China, using the Islamists as it did in Afghanistan. For this reason, Beijing closed the road from Karakoram connecting Xinjiang to Pakistan between 1992 and 1995. Since 1996, the frequency of the incidents has skyrocketed. In February of 1997, riots exploded in Yining, a town of 300,000 inhabitants located to the west of Urumqi near the Kazakh border. This violence caused 10 deaths, according to Chinese authorities, and the Uyghurs have counted more than 100 victims. Every week in 1998 saw a bombing or an attack with automatic weapons. The region's hotels, airports, and railway stations are in a constant state of alert. In April, Chinese authorities in the vicinity of Yining seized 700 cases of ammunition shipped from Kazakhstan. In September, the secretary of the Xinjiang Communist Party declared that, quote, 19 training camps in which specialists returning from Afghanistan educate young recruits in the techniques of terrorism with the assistance of the Taliban, unquote, were neutralized. In January 1999, 29 activists implicated in the February 1997 riots were arrested. On February 12th, violent clashes between the police and groups of Uyghur militants wounded several dozen people in Urumqi. 200 people were arrested, and in early March, 10,000 additional soldiers arrived at Yining to beef up security, while in Beijing, the Uyghur Islamist organizations took credit for several bomb attacks. This Asian testbed is supporting the emergence of a new type of radicalism. Sunnite and ideologically conservative, it is supranational in its recruitment and in its ideology. It does not emanate out of scissions in the great Islamist organizations, but from a radicalization of the Afghan Talibans, from their sanctuaries and their ties with small terrorist and mafia groups, marginalized and radicalized by repression, as in Egypt and Algeria, in a context of economic and financial globalization, as well as from the circulation of militants who have lost their territories. Consider the possibility of utilizing the Uyghurs and Taliban connections either to split off and destabilize Xinjiang or perhaps to prod the Chinese into a more cooperative policy with regard to sharing the development of their resources. The Chinese have specifically charged al-Qaeda and bin Laden with involvement with the Uyghurs. This charge carried in, among other papers, the New York Times of Tuesday, January 22nd of 2002. An article by Elizabeth Rosenthal, datelined Beijing, January 21st, headlined, Beijing says Chinese Muslims were trained as terrorists with money from bin Laden. Seeking to justify its harsh treatment of Muslims living in China's far western region of Xinjiang, Chinese officials asserted today that a small separatist movement there was being financed and supported by Osama bin Laden, and that more than 100 terrorists who had trained at camps in Afghanistan had been arrested in China. In a new report, the government asserted that Mr. bin Laden himself had met with radical Chinese Muslims and that, quote, bin Laden terrorists and Taliban leaders, unquote, had allocated, quote, a fabulous sum of money for the training of the East Turkestan terrorists. Backup of that, the Chronicle of Monday, January 28th of 2002, article by Ellen Nickmeyer of the Associated Press, U.S. forces clash with al-Qaeda gunmen. Skipping down, in December, two of the gunmen were captured when soldiers used the only doctor the men trusted to trick them. The captured men were handed over to U.S. forces, who have set up a military base at the Kandahar airport. They were both Chinese, presumably militant Uyghurs demanding independence for their Muslim-dominated northwest province of China. Now, consider also the manipulation of the Indian-Pakistani conflict and the well-documented connections between al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the Pakistani secret services. Al-Qaeda appears to have utilized the hostilities between India and Pakistan, and specifically an attack on the Indian parliament. That has apparently helped to make the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan more porous, and it may make it more porous still. Financial Times of Friday, December 21st of the year 2001, an article by Farhan Bokhari in Lahore, Pakistan. This is headlined, Kashmir Could Trigger Al-Qaeda Escape. Pakistan could immediately move thousands of troops from its western border with Afghanistan in the event of an Indian attack in Kashmir, although this would leave a large gap for Al-Qaeda fighters to enter the country, senior government officials and analysts said yesterday. One question to ask is that whether perhaps that Al-Qaeda attack on the Indian parliament, which obviously made the Pakistani-Indian confrontation more tense, may have been intended to do exactly that. Interestingly, Austria also appears to be an area where Al-Qaeda fighters are heading for as a place of refuge. This might be considered sort of a far western front, just as the India-Pakistan situation might be considered the opening up of a southern front and a southern escape route if, in fact, tensions escalate with the results speculated about there. The San Francisco Chronicle of January 22nd of the year 2002 had an article by Eric Geiger headlined, Austrian Border Offers Al-Qaeda a New Gateway to Europe. Thanks to a little-known Austrian court decision, hundreds of illegal immigrants are pouring into Western Europe virtually every week without hindrance, fugitive Afghan Taliban fighters, and members of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda terrorist network allegedly among them. Skipping down. The gateway for the influx is a 65-mile stretch of border between Austria and Slovakia that is normally closely monitored. Now, we're going to be talking about Austria and some of its politics vis-a-vis the Middle East, and in particular, a fellow named Jörg Haider. First, note the following article. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 306. There was a very interesting article that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle about an Iraqi arms dealer who serves as a conduit of aid from the far right and explicitly fascist elements in Europe to Saddam Hussein and Iraq. This article was published in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, May 3rd of the year 2001. It's by Eric Geiger of the Chronicle Foreign Service. It's headlined, Convicted Arms Dealer Funnels Aid from Europe's Far Right to Iraq. Subtitled, Austrian German Neo-Nazi Groups Are Fans of Hussein. And it's datelined, Sowjet unter Glan, Austria. The article reads in part, Until recently, residents of this sleepy village took little notice of a portly, middle-aged Arab businessman living inconspicuously on the edge of town with his family, assuming him to be a successful carpet dealer. But Austrian media, citing security authorities, identified Abdul Monim Jebara, J-E-B-A-R-A, 60, as a convicted Iraqi arms dealer allegedly acting as Saddam Hussein's liaison with sympathetic far-rightist groups in Europe. Quote, He calls himself a mere export and import trader, but Austrian and German security agencies see Jebara as a pivot of an alarmingly close cooperation emerging in recent months between extreme rightists in the two countries and radical Islamists, unquote, said Vienna's usually well-informed and influential news magazine Format. From his hilltop bungalow sporting satellite dishes and surveillance cameras, Jebara allegedly is coordinating unspecified aid programs from a network of far-rightist supporters in Europe for Iraq, which is still under UN sanctions imposed in 1990 after its invasion of Kuwait. What seems to unite the European far-rightists and the Iraqis are their common anti-Semitic and anti-American sentiments. In its latest report on the rightist scene in Germany, the Agency of the Protection of the Constitution, a sort of German FBI, said, quote, The American democratic system is seen by the two groups as an expression of cultural decadence and economic imperialism, unquote. A recent debate in Austria's parliament seemed to suggest that since settling in Sowjet, near Klagenfurt in Carinthia province in the early 1990s, Jebara has enjoyed the protection of high-level politicians who are aware of his activities and background, quote, How is it possible that a man of Jebara's caliber, who is known to have close contacts to the extreme rightist and the Iraqi Secret Service, and served part of a 6-year sentence for arms dealing, blackmail, and tax evasion in Germany, was allowed to settle in Austria, unquote, thundered Karl Ohlinger, a prominent opposition Green Party lawmaker. Austria's 15-month-old center-far-right coalition government quickly passed the buck, saying that attempts to start deportation proceedings against Jabara have always been thwarted by Carinthian authorities. Jörg Haider, founder of the far-right Freedom Party and still its driving force, is Carinthia's governor. In an interview last week, Haider insisted that provincial authorities have no power to block proceedings related to federal alien laws. Please note that Jabara's base of operations is in Carinthia province, and the governor of Carinthia is Jörg Haider. Umberto Bossi of the Liga Norte in Italy, part of the Berlusconi coalition that I alluded to earlier in this broadcast, is also very closely allied with Jörg Haider, whose xenophobic anti-immigrant arguments have sounded a resonant theme and a very sympathetic note in much of the European Union, and they also echo themes that one hears from far-right and fascist elements in the United States as well. Returning to this Chronicle article, in an interview last week, Haider insisted that provincial authorities have no power to block proceedings related to federal alien laws. He also denied media reports quoting Jabara as saying he knows Haider well. Quote, "I'm vaguely familiar with the case, but I have never met that man, Jabara, and never had any contact whatever with him. I am being blamed for just about everything these days," unquote. Among those reportedly spearheading the effort to funnel aid to Iraq is Germany's National Democratic Party, which openly woos skinheads and sponsors annual protests marking the 1987 death in prison of Hitler deputy Rudolf Hess that often wind up in neo-Nazi violence. The party, which all German Democratic parties seek to ban, recently proclaimed, quote, "strong support for suffering Iraqis," unquote, on its internet homepage. Again quoting, "The so-called Community of Nations Against Iraq is a structure held together by means of blackmail, lies, bribery, corruption, and violence by the satraps of the East Coast," the statement said, using a term far-rightists usually apply to the U.S. Jewish community. Also regularly expressing, quote, "solidarity," unquote, with Hussein's regime is the Munich weekly Deutsche National Zeitung. Circulation, turning to the inside of this article, 130,000, 115,000 in Austria. Its owner is Bavarian millionaire publisher Gerhard Frey, leader of the German People's Party, DVU, a group accused of racism and anti-Semitism that won 13% of the 1998 vote in the eastern state of Saxony-Anhalt. By the way, we've spoken about Gerhard Frey in numerous broadcasts. He's an individual with more connections, as I say, than a switchboard. He was one of the major funding conduits for Vladimir Zhirinovsky's early political rise in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was in the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldatenzeitung that the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot at General Edwin Walker was first published. This several days before that information supposedly first surfaced to the light of day in an interview that Marina Oswald gave to the FBI. Returning once again to this article, after discussing support for Jabara and for Saddam Hussein by Gerhard Frey, in an editorial, speaking of the Deutsche National Zeitung, in an editorial, the weekly attacked the United States for keeping Iraq in a, quote, "stranglehold," unquote, and asserted that Germany spent $18.8 billion in tax money to help finance the Persian Gulf War, quote, "even though Germany was in no way threatened by Baghdad," unquote. The publication also ridiculed as ludicrous horror stories, unquote, recent media reports that the German intelligence agency has new evidence that Hussein has revived his nuclear weapons production and may be capable of making an atomic bomb within the next 3 years. Openly pitching for cash for our Iraqi brothers, unquote, are leaflets issued by a shadowy organization calling itself German and Austrian Patriots, unquote. The flyer's signatories include Franz Schoenhuber, 78, the former Waffen-SS sergeant who co-founded the once surging extreme-rightist Republikaner Party, and the leader of a Salzburg-based neo-Nazi group identified only as Richard R. Security officials say funds and commodities collected for Iraq on humanitarian grounds, unquote, are usually channeled to Jeanine Le Pen, the wife of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of France's far-right National Front. Running a special aid organization called SCS, Children of Iraq, she then arranges for the transfer to Baghdad. The idea of helping Saddam Hussein seems to have a bizarre unifying effect on assorted extreme rightist groups, not only in Austria and Germany, but also in the rest of Europe, unquote, said the Austrian security official. Apparently,
That's where Hussein's man in St. Viet comes in. That is the reference to Jabara. That reference, I should say, is to Jabara. In an impassioned plea for donations for Iraq, published recently by the Austrian far-rightist periodical Rule, Jabara was named as, or Rule, maybe, maybe that's not anglicized, the Austrian far-rightist periodical Rule, Jabara was named as, quote, coordinator for the aid action for Iraq by German patriots, unquote. Questioned about it by Austrian reporters in January, Jabara not only did not deny his role as aid coordinator, unquote, but also minced no words about his admiration for Hussein and proudly showed off a wristwatch whose dial showed a portrait of the Iraqi despot. Quote, "The Iraqi people are starving, our children are starving, and Bill Clinton, then U.S. president, is much worse than Hitler," he said. "The people helping us are just ordinary young people who finally recognize what the truth is, and besides, their ideology resembles ours," unquote. By the way, I would also note the considerable sympathy for Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi position in the American left as well. It's one of the reasons why one finds far more overlap between elements generally regarded as on the left and on the right than one might suspect. Continuing. Jabara, a former resident of Munich, was sentenced in 1986 to 6.5 years in prison for attempting to smuggle 40 combat helicopters from Germany to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, as well as for trying to blackmail a business partner. The verdict specifically referred to Jabara's, quote, close contacts, unquote, with high-level Iraqi government and Secret Service officials, including Hussein's top security officer and the chief of the National Procurement Agency, unquote. According to Format, Jabara also was questioned in the court in connection with the reported participation of German firms in the construction of chemical weapon plants at Iraq's heavily guarded Samarra industrial complex. The magazine said he was accused of engineering a hostage-taking plot in Iraq to force his release from prison. Jabara has vehemently denied both allegations. Jabara was prematurely released from prison for unknown reasons in the early 1990s, and his motive for moving to Austria is also unclear. But some analysts point out that before the Gulf War, Iraq was Austria's most important trading partner in the Middle East, with Austrian exports amounting to about $400 million annually. State-owned and private companies such as Voest Alpine, OMV, and ELIN, all in capitals, E-L-I-N, did large-scale business in the fields of manufactured goods, oil, and power plant construction, respectively. The Gulf War and the embargo ended the Austrian-Iraqi trade almost completely, and that's why it was with satisfaction that the easing of the sanctions in recent years was registered here, unquote, said the Vienna Daily Standard. That, again, from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, May 3rd of the year 2001. And again, we've talked about Saddam Hussein and some of the fascist antecedents of Iraqi extreme nationalism. There was an anti-British pro-Axis uprising in Iraq led by Ali Rashid in 1940, I think it was. It was during World War II, and I believe off the top of my head it was 1940. One of Ali Rashid's supporters was an Iraqi army officer named Karula al-Tufa, who is the uncle of Saddam Hussein and who was Saddam Hussein's mentor, political mentor, to a large extent. Saddam Hussein, by the way, owns Hitler's personal Mercedes, which is said to be his favorite car, and there are areas of overlap between the Ba'ath Party ideology and its extreme racist racial nationalism and the Nazi Party ideology of Adolf Hitler. I'm not saying the two are identical, but there are areas of overlap in the doctrinaire militarism, the worship of war, and also the extreme racial nationalism that infect both philosophies. And again, Karula al-Tufa was the most important political influence on Saddam Hussein, and he was an admirer of Hitler and was a participant in the Ali Rashid uprising against the British in 1940. That, once again, excerpted from For the Record program number 306. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 348 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Within the description for the Record 348, there will also be links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU. WFMU.org/Dave Emery has more recent For the Record programs streaming. There is a longer URL which has virtually the entire For the Record series available for download only on Real Audio. That concludes For the Record 348.
Side 1, being recorded on February 17th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.